Welcome to The Protagonistas, a podcast that is centered on highlighting the stories and experiences of Black, Indigenous, and other women of color among communities of faith. Our conversations sit at the intersection of race, gender, sexuality, and spirituality. I'm your host, Kat Armas. Hello, friends. I'm so glad to be bringing another episode to you today, and this one is a good one. I get to chat with Patty Krawek, who is an Anishinaabe and Ukrainian writer from Lac Seul First Nation. She's the co-host of the Medicine for Resistance podcast. Y'all, I had so much fun chatting with Patty. Her new book, Becoming Kin, An Indigenous Call to Unforgetting the Past and Reimagining Our Future, is so good and informative and invites us to see the world anew. Patty and I chat about so many good things. We start by chatting about this notion of unforgetting, which I so was drawn to. We also talk about the Anishinaabe worldview, how it intersects with Christianity and how it doesn't. We talk about land and humans and how we have a lot in common. We also chat about paying attention, arguing with God, and so many other rich and vibrant things that had my soul stirring. For hundreds of years, the church had given little care or thought to the small magics of life, Patty says, and this conversation is sure to get you thinking about those small magics, a grace and a gift. I so hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did, friends, and please don't forget to leave a review if you haven't already. Welcome to The Protagonistas. Okay, I am so incredibly excited to have Patty Krawek with me here today. Patty, loved your book. I am so happy that you wrote it. There was just so much incredible, necessary, great information. I felt like I was just drinking in a well of just so much beautiful information, and just the way that you interweaved it into your story and the story of your people and the story of all of us, right? A collective us. I think that it's such a gift to the world and the church in particular, those of us who live under the veil of colonization. And so I am so thankful for your work, and I'm so excited that you're here. So thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Okay. So I always start by asking folks what their spiritual background is. I would love to hear just where you are now and how you got here as far as spirituality.
So I grew up, so first few years, no church at all. Until I was probably about 9 years old. And then I grew up with my mom's family. So maternal family, German, Ukrainian refugees, they came in the 50s. There was no real church affiliation. Mom remarried. So then kind of my formative time was spent in the evangelical church. Spent a lot of time in the evangelical church. You know, I remember the Satanic Panic. I remember all those rapture movies that came out in the 70s and 80s. Reading James Dobson and all of those guys. And then I was, well, two things happened. I found my father, who's Ojibwe. So I found him. And although I had always known that I was Native, being the white kid in the brown, being the brown kid in the white family, it's hard to hide. So I found him. So that kind of set my path on a different, meeting other people, meeting other Native people, hearing about Indigenous, Ojibwe cosmology and how we understood our place in the world. And then one day I realized that my entire social circle was inside the church, and that was really unhealthy. Mm-hmm. It occurred to me that I didn't know my neighbors. I didn't know anybody. Everybody I knew was inside the church. And so that was really unhealthy. And so I started volunteering. And I wound up at a rape crisis center. And to my shock, here were non-Christians doing very good work in the community. Because if you're familiar with the evangelical world, all goodness comes from God and the church.
Right.
And the world was something we were supposed to be scared of and convert if possible, but otherwise stay away from. And so here are these good people who not only weren't Christians, but didn't want to be Christians. They knew enough about it. They didn't want it. And they were doing very good work in the community. And that was really destabilizing for me. But then rather than snap back and retreat into the church, I kept going. Mm. I kept going and building these relationships with the Indigenous community, with, you know, Indigenous relatives, with my father, with, you know, other people in the community doing good work. And then that just really started fracturing how I thought of the church as this kind of little closed circle of the only source of goodness. And then that started me kind of questioning everything. And I mean, you've seen in the book that I'm basically, what if we looked at this story differently? Right. What if we thought about that differently?
That's
what a
so
different
good.
World it would be.
Right. Oh, yes. Yes. I love that you mentioned that, though, that it's this, you know, so much of our, and by our, I just mean evangelical dominant culture, spirituality is upheld by fear, right? Mm-hmm. But then once we kind of let go of that fear, or even just lean into like, why am I afraid? Or what does this fear stem from? We find out that it's not actually there, you know, there isn't anything to be afraid of. It's almost like the devil has more power than God, you know, in many evangelical circles, like the devil is lurking everywhere, but God was nowhere to be found, right? We need to be afraid of everything. So I just love that, you know, it was almost like you not necessarily leaned into the fear, but you kind of gave that fear up to, you know, realize that, hey, people in the world are doing amazing things. And what if we all teamed up together, right? So much liberation can be found instead of, you know, fighting over, I want to do this good work. And, you know, I want it, whatever. I don't know. It's so bizarre.
And tying all the good works to proselytizing.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Right. You know, like here were good people doing good work and they really didn't care what I believed.
Exactly.
Or that I should, you know, we needed to both agree that rape victims weren't responsible for what happened to them, you know,
right.
So we needed to agree on those kind of baseline things,
right,
but they
right.
didn't really care about otherwise converting me to their belief system. We were just
right.
working together towards a common goal. And I was like, wow, what a neat world it would be if we did that.
Know.
You know, but
I
Christians
know.
Are just so focused. The evangelical Christians that I grew up with are just so focused on this other world that they're going to get to. This, you know, this world is not their home, that they're not
right.
investing in this world at all.
Right,
and look where that's gotten us.
Yes. Yeah. And it's rooted in that conquering mentality, you know, as you talk about in your book, and it's like this idea of like, you know, we have to conquer. And in fact, actually you write a little bit about this. I was going to ask you this later, but I think this is a perfect place to ask you this. So you mentioned a really beautiful and interesting distinction that I love. So I'm working on the manuscript for my second book, and we're trying to reclaim the devotional space. By we, I mean my publisher and I, but you know, devotionals a lot of times can feel fluffy, and you know, and so I really want to dig in deeper. And one of my sections is on creation. I'm just looking at different verses and kind of wrestling with creation and how God, you know, intersects with that. So one of the things that you said just stood out to me so beautifully. And as I mentioned, it's an interesting distinction, and it might seem like a small detail, but it's not at all. And I think that this is why it's so good. So you say that in church, you say that in church, we were taught, instead of, quote, listening to the land, what it might say for itself, we listen only for what God might be saying through it. And you say exactly, reducing it to an empty vessel. And then you continue, this diminishes our investment in the world around us and disconnects us from everything, including people, because we don't listen to them either. And I, like I said, I love this connection and distinction, not just listening to what God might speak through the land or even through people, right? But what the land, what animals, what plants are saying in and of themselves. I think this also connects to the idea that you also mentioned, that settlers had good news for us, for Indigenous peoples, but not that there was good news for them to receive. And so I just love that little distinction of not that the land, that God speaks through the land, but the land is speaking in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say more about that? And it also just people, right? Like we don't need, like everything has, you know, a means to an end, like so that we can proselytize, so we can evangelize. But what if like you mentioned, what if we just love people because we love people, right? Or what if we just help people because we want to help people? Or what if the land speaks because the land speaks? Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so I've got two dogs in my room right now. And I mean, and this may seem like all like mystical stuff. Ooh, what's the river saying to me?
You can, no, don't worry, not at all.
And I'm probably like the least woo-woo Native person you'll ever come across. Mostly because I have so little patience for that stereotype that, you know, oh, you know, we're so mystically connected to the land. It's like, no, we're just paying attention.
That's good. We're
paying attention, and really anybody can do it. But, you know, I can think about my dogs. My dogs communicate things very clearly to me, whether they want to go inside or not, whether they want to come with me or not, whether they're hungry, they're communicating very clearly to me.
Right.
My son would have like entire conversations with his dog, and they understood each other very clearly. You know, and so it's just extending that relationship to the fact that animals are communicating things very clearly to us. The land is communicating things very clearly to us. You know, the river moves where it moves for a reason. You know, it's in relationship with the land around it. You know, it doesn't just flow in a straight line. I saw a thing about the Mississippi and all of the different places, you know, ways that it had flowed. And so it's in relationship with the land. And what if we just allowed that that had meaning? And so then what is that say? What is that saying to us? We don't even need to be super mystical about it.
Right.
We just need to pay attention. Well, what is it saying? Why is the land, which is, you know, a collective of, you know, soil and microbes and plants and all kinds of things, what is it telling us in this current climate situation about the way we're living? What if we just listen to it as a being in its own right? Instead of, oh, you know, always thinking about what is God trying to say to us through this thing. Well, maybe we should just listen to that and see what that's trying to say. And then we could listen to God on their own terms.
Right.
Instead of trying to filter God through these, through all of these other things. Maybe that's why we don't, you know, we'll so often say that they can't hear God. They can't hear God. Well, they're so busy filtering them through everything else around them that they can't hear what God is saying anyway. So give everybody their own place. If we said that in our families, I'm going to listen to you because I want to hear what grandpa might be saying through you. Well, no, I could listen to grandpa on his own and I can listen to you. And I might hear echoes of grandpa in you, like assuming that we're cousins. I could hear echoes because you are also in relationship with grandpa, but you're speaking that stuff on your own terms. If I want to know what grandpa says, I got to talk to him.
That is so good. That is so good. Thank you. And it seems, like I said, it seems like such a almost obvious thing, but it's not. You know, I think the way that we think is so deeply embedded into, you know, this, that God uses us and you know, I've written about this before in the past of how I'm not particularly comfortable with that language of use, right? That God uses things. I like to think that we are in a reciprocal, you know, that we have agency too, and that we work alongside God, right? It's a relationship that we're all, you know, we're all doing this thing together. And so as you're speaking, I think of that, like, you know, the land is in relationship to God and our creator, right? And animal, you know, we're all in this divine relationship with one another, with each other. And so God's not using anyone. Instead, you know, we're all kind of active in this, which makes it so much more beautiful.
Imagine if we talked about our children that way.
Right.
Like I'm using them to do housework. No, like they're doing some housework. They're helping with housework and I'm helping with this. And then when that's all done, we can go out and do something together. If we talk about God like it's an abusive relationship. And I don't know, the way I was raised in the evangelical church, it kind of is an abusive relationship.
Oh, yeah, 100%, 100%. And so it makes sense, right? It's comfortable because it is a very sort of abusive relationship. So anyways, thank you for sharing that. That was so good. You also said something that I thought was really good, and it might kind of relate to this. So I know, you know, as we talk about this notion, and again, a collective, we talk about this notion of decolonizing, or talk about, you know, this sort of things of divesting from colonial ways of thinking and being. A lot of times it's hard to think that, like, for example, Indigenous spirituality or decolonized spirituality might be in line with Christianity. But you actually do some beautiful work in your book, and I'll kind of quote you here, and then you could talk more about it. But you say Anishinaabe worldview is not inconsistent with what Christianity could be, which I love that could be, because it's not what Christianity is, but what it could be. And then you kind of talk about, like, as an example, the original instructions, right, that God gave God's people of connection, relationship with land and people, and, you know, that sort of thing. So the original, you know, sort of view that when we read the Bible really through a non, you know, Western colonial mindset, we can see so many of these beautiful connections. I mean, Israel was so connected to their land. Now, granted, you know, there are instructions of conquest, you know, of Canaan and all these things that, you know, of course we need to critique and call out. But as far as the Israel as a people and God as a creator, there are so many beautiful connections that we can see in sort of in a decolonized view. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about that and what connections you see.
So original instructions is kind of a language that I'm not sure that I wouldn't use anymore. Not that I disagree with myself, but just that it suggests a return to a kind of purity that I'm not sure it existed. And I'm not sure that, you know, ideas of purity always get us into trouble, right? Because right, then right. They become things that we impose on other people. But the idea, I think I would just convey that idea a little bit differently in terms of we need to think more relationally, mm-hmm. right? And what you've described, you know, what's kind of in the Hebrew text, you know, what's in the older stories, they're all about relational. They're about, you know, the Hebrew people coming in. And I mean, yes, there's narratives of conquest, but there's also narratives of relationship building. Because I mean, really, Israel failed in the conquest of Canaan, just like the Europeans failed in their conquest of North America, because we are still here, right? You know, and the indigenous, we, you and I, as indigenous people, we're still here. So obviously they failed. And Standing Rock and Wet'suwet'en and all these land back actions still exist, because although they drew these borders around us, they have not yet taken control of all the land, and they forget that. So we need to remind them. So what has been really helpful for me is listening to Jewish voices, mm-hmm. listening, because as growing up in the evangelical church, you know, we have this idea that, you know, the Old Testament God is angry and, you know, focused on the law and all of that stuff. And the New Testament God is full of grace, and it's a New Testament. It's a new covenant. And, you know, and
like, so Jesus kind of invented grace.
Although Jesus talked way more about hell and judgment and casting people out than, you know, that the Hebrew text did. And the Hebrew text is full of commands to be generous and gracious. Right, and imagine if we enacted the system of Jubilee, right? Every 50 years, the big economic reset to prevent the accumulation of wealth, you know, and, you know, it's getting back to understanding ourselves in relationships, kinship rather than citizenship, because kinship is an expansive way of understanding how we get along with each other. So talking to Jewish people and getting their perspectives on, you know, on this text that, you know, Christians have claimed and appropriated and colonized. And it reads so much differently, because that personhood or agency of the land becomes very visible. You know, the trees will clap their hands with joy is not a metaphor. The prophets mm-hmm. were saying that the trees had the capacity to express joy. Yeah. So they were understanding things about the world that somehow Christians have stripped away from it. So understanding, you know, that kind of Jewish perspective of relationship and responsibility to each other and the consequences to the land if we don't, because if we don't allow, you know, if we force the land to absorb the consequences of our actions, the land is going to have a reaction to that. And the land did have a reaction to that, you know, in the older texts, and the land is having a reaction to that now. You know, and that's things that we've cared about and things that we haven't cared about that's happening to us. So, yeah, so it's that idea of always kind of coming back to those relationships. And even in the original story of creation, that was what happened, was a fracturing of relationships. So how do we constantly, how are we always rebuilding? And that to me is the story of the Bible, is this constant rebuilding of relationship through migration, through hardship, through trauma. It's a constant rebuilding of relationship. Okay, things have come apart. How do we put them back together? And every generation, I saw a rabbi tweeting that, you know, every generation reads the text anew. And I thought, what a beautiful way to think about it. every generation coming to it. So what is this saying to me now? How do I understand these things now? What is this saying to me now? And I think, and that's why I wove in Ojibwe stories as well, because that too calls us to relationship, calls us to relationship in the midst of migration. And how do we understand our stories differently? How do we understand them in the world that we're in now? And how do they teach us how to be good relatives to each other? And, you know, Nana Bush gets into a lot of trouble. So he shows us the consequence of not being a good relationship.
That's so good. So yeah, I want to ask you a follow-up question about stories, because you talk a lot about stories. But before I ask you that question, I meant to ask you this first, but we got into something else. Can you talk to folks, because I think it's even in your title, in your subtitle, this notion of unforget or unforgetting. I love it. I love, you know, it's a sort of a new term, and it's, you know, it takes a second to, you know, you have to actually stop and think about, what does it mean to unforget something, right? At least for me, it did. It took me a second. I'm like, wait, unforget, you know, and I love anything that makes me stop and like recalibrate my brain. I love. So can you talk to us about unforgetting? What does it mean to you? And can you talk to me about your personal journey of unforgetting, which, you know, you do so beautifully in the book?
Okay, so unforgetting is a term I came across in an interview of Upping the Ante is a Canadian journal. And I read an interview in there with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and she talked about unforgetting. And because she said in Greek, the opposite of truth is forgetting. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to, and so then, you know, she did the Google Translate thing, right? So if the opposite of truth is forgetting, then the opposite, then truth would be unforgetting. Mm. So there's these things that we know, there's these histories that have never been lost, that have always been held in our communities, that have not been taught in schools, that are not relayed in Hollywood, that are not, you know, kind of part of the national narrative, you know, and so we need to unforget them. We know them collectively, they're part of us. So we need to pull them back forward. We need to bring them back into the center. And you're seeing this with kind of the, you know, the current, you know, historians that are doing all of the writing.
Right.
They're retelling these old these histories. And, you know, the right is getting very upset about that because they worked very hard on that lost cause narrative to shift the way we think about the Civil War, to shift the way that we think about, you know, Jim Crow and all those things. They worked very hard at forgetting these histories and kind of creating this collective forgetting. And yet it's always been there. It's always been there, held in the fringes, you know, held, you know, in by our grandparents, you know, and people who aren't in the center of things. But when we listen to them, and so for me, it was really about examining the stories we weren't told. I mean, you know, Kelly Hayes, activist in Chicago and writer for Truth Out magazine. And she had that beautiful phrase where she talked about investigating the history, the stories we were not told. And so that's what I set out to do, to investigate these stories. What wasn't I told? What wasn't, you know, people are appalled at, you know, in Canada last year where they found the unmarked graves of the children, and people were appalled. And yet it's a whole book in the Truth and Reconciliation Report that came out, you know, 6 years earlier. Right. So how do you be surprised by something that was reported on 6 years ago that survivors have been talking about for decades? How do you be surprised?
Right.
Because nobody's talking about it. And so now we're going to talk about it. And so what else haven't we been told? You know, I remember my cousin was little. She found out Santa Claus wasn't real. She was furious. What else have you lied to me about?
Right.
You know, and so it really is unforgetting, really is that process. Okay. So you didn't tell. What else haven't you told us? What else have you lied to us about? And then it's about finding those other histories and listening to other voices and looking for other perspectives, because those histories are contained within the things that we do know. You just have to kind of look, okay, so they got from here to there. What happened in the middle? What happened in the middle? Because there's no way they just got from here to suddenly big cities. Something happened. Yeah. And so the clues are there. The clues are there. And it's just, so unforgetting is that process of looking through and finding the stuff that really, and then as we learn it, we're not that surprised. We're like, oh, okay, now that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so good. It also makes me think of, so my first book I wrote, it's called Abuelita Faith. And I talk about so much of our, and abuelita meaning grandmother in Spanish. And I talk so much about this embodied wisdom that our ancestors and that our grandmothers hold, right? It's like a wisdom that lives in our bodies. You know, I talk about my grandmother immigrated from Cuba, and I talk about how, you know, I've never lived in Cuba, but I feel like Cuba lives in me because my body knows. My body has this knowledge of a land of my ancestors, right? And so when I think about unforgetting and everything that you're sharing, it's this idea, at least for me, that we know things in our bodies, like we carry a generational trauma and a generational knowing. It's just a matter of, right? Like it's there. It, you know, we haven't, it's just a matter of, you know, bringing that up to the surface. Like, oh yes, I felt that. I knew in my body. Right. And maybe, you know, I didn't know that I knew because of all of the other stories that have been told, you know, as you mentioned, you know, they, all these stories that have been given to us that aren't, you know, maybe true or aren't the full story or aren't, you know, but yeah, I love, you know, kind of connecting this to like a bodily knowing, right? Like that, you know, that there is a wisdom there that we haven't been taught to look for or lean into.
Hey everyone, it's Kat. As a space for highlighting the stories of Black, Indigenous, and other women of color, this podcast has been important for so many listeners. And I would not be able to do this podcast if it weren't for the support of every single one of you. But beyond listening, you can help the show in other ways too. The first is obviously by heading over to your podcast app of choice and writing us a review. It helps the show greatly and doesn't cost you a dime to do it. That said, if you do have the funds to support the show, head over to patreon.com/theprotagonistas to learn more how your dollars can go to help fuel the growth of this podcast. For just a cup of coffee per month, you can keep this important work going. Again, that's patreon.com/theprotagonistas.
We're told to listen to what other things might be saying through us. We're not told to listen to us.
Yeah.
Not told to listen to our, well, when I started working for the Sexual Assault Center, one of the trainers said that so much of her work was about training women to listen to, she called it that uh-oh feeling, because we're taught not to listen to it, right? We're taught to put it aside. Oh, it's not that bad. He's just joking. They don't mean it, whatever, blah, blah, blah. We're taught not to listen to that. And yet, like you say, our body knows, our body remembers things, and it remembers, it carries things. I mean, our DNA, my friend of mine will talk endlessly about epigenetic trauma. You know, these things that we inherit, but we also inherit the strengths, right? I mean, there's survival in the fact that we're still here.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, and we inherit those things too, but you got to go back to Cuba. You got to go to Cuba.
Yeah.
Like you must have loved that part where I talk about going home.
Yeah.
In the land remembering me. Cuba knows you. You got to get to Cuba. Yeah. Oh, Cuba's waiting for you.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so I want to talk about stories. You know, you've mentioned already several times, and earlier you mentioned, you know, stories of your people and stories of, you know, that have shaped you. And I think that something that's so beautiful that you mentioned in your book, and I'm going to quote you, and I would love to for you to, you know, kind of elaborate on it. But you talk about multiple creation stories and how they emerge from multiple gardens, describe the relationships of multiple peoples. There is not a single story to which we must all be reconciled, not a single story with a single message, not a single narrative that provides its bearer with authority and power to control the lives of others. So I often talk about how in the dominant culture or like colonial ideologies, it does not know what to do with multiplicity, right? With complexity, with gray areas. Western ideology only understands binaries and dichotomies, or lives by these like binaries, either or dichotomies. And it only understands one story, right? And so kind of what we were talking about earlier, it's this one story that you have to buy into in order to be quote unquote saved or, you know, and I think you mentioned something so wonderful here, and that's that, you know, in sort of in my own words, that decolonizing involves holding on to multiple stories, multiple truths can exist at the exact same time, right? So can you talk to us more about that, how you have experienced this idea of multiplicity in your own life, particularly when it comes to stories?
Wow, that's a really good question. Because, yeah, I mean, because I did grow up with that single story, right? You know, and, you know, and even, you know, when people will talk about, they'll hear the Ojibwe creation story about, that's like, no, it's not like Adam and Eve. It's a very different story from Adam, from Adam and Eve. It's not like, or the flood story. No, that's not like our version of Noah's Ark. It's a very different story. Very different story. Nana Bush found those animals on the log, or maybe they found him. I don't know. He didn't save anybody. He wasn't building boats and saving anybody. So they're very different stories. And so it's different perspectives. And I think that is really hard for Western thinkers, because the Enlightenment and that thinking emerged in a world where there was only one story. And then everything kind of related to that story. Well, how does that support or diminish, right? How does this, and if it diminishes, then we're going to reject it as being not true. And if it supports it, then we're going to allow them to keep that. Mm. Whereas here, I mean, I live in the Niagara region. So I'm Ojibwe, Anishinaabe Ojibwe, living in Mississauga, Anishinaabe territory, also Haudenosaunee territory, so the Iroquois, people may be more familiar with the term Iroquois. So we're all living here together. We all have different creation stories.
Right.
We all have very different political systems, in terms of how we organize ourselves. And yet we're still able to share space to run a friendship center with sometimes different ways of thinking. And it's understanding that, I put it, Alan, there's an Anishinaabe legal scholar whose name is eluding me right now, but he has this really beautiful phrase about thickness, about variations in the thickness of our lived relationship. So there's the way I think and the way I understand life to be. And, I have a very anarchist kind of way of framing, is we're going to build our community and our community is going to kind of live the way we live and we're not going to interfere. So that's a principle of non-interference. As long as you're not hurting us, you can, or hurting other people in your, you can live how you need to live. If you're not hurting us, then you live how you live and you're going to live how you live. And then in that borders between us, there's going to be more or less of how many of us there are and how much control we have over the space around us. And so it's learning to live in that. I'm not really explaining this very well. I think it's a non-interference is probably the best way I can think about it, is understanding that as long as that person or that community is not hurting me or my community, I don't have to interfere.
Right.
I don't have to be right. And that's probably the hardest thing for me to let go of. Having been raised, evangelical, having been raised and educated in a Western system, letting go of the idea that I have to be right and I have to, academia, right? You got to make your thesis, you got to defend your thesis. And that's okay, but I have to leave room for people to disagree with me, because there's also learning that happens in the middle of that too. And other ways for me to look at things that might be more helpful in this moment. Kelly, again, like we were at a conference together and she talked about being an ideologically promiscuous, as opposed to saying that, she's a socialist or a Marxist or whatever, right. Because different things, and this is again where multiplicity is really helpful, different perspectives are better for different problems.
Right.
The Haudenosaunee kind of rigid way of governance is very helpful in some circumstances, is very useful. In other circumstances, it may not be. The Anishinaabeg, more anarchist, kind of loosey way of doing it may be more helpful. And so it's important to understand who's involved and what the situation is. And that non-interference is really important, but the Western mindset doesn't understand non-interference because they'd be interfering everywhere.
Right. That's so good. That reminds me, I actually wrote about this, or I posted on social media or something recently, and it's one of my favorite bits of parenting advice that I've received. As I told you, and as I'm sure most of my listeners know, I've had a baby recently. And so one of my favorite bits of parenting advice is, when your child is like engaged in play or something, or when your child is in the corner doing something, resist the urge as the one, with power, and I put this in notions of like power. But as the one with power, resist thinking that you're the only one with knowledge. So you don't have to run and interrupt your child or interfere, as you mentioned, to try and teach your child a lesson. Trust that your child is engaged in learning on their own, right? Trust that your child is sitting there, you know, whether it's putting a block on the wrong way or playing with a toy wrong, and I mean wrong in quotation marks, or you know, playing with something, you know, not the quote unquote right way. Just assume that they know, you know, whether they know what they're doing, assume that they're learning, assume that there's wisdom there, right? And yeah, resist the urge to interrupt them. And I think about that all the time because, you know, those of us with varying levels of privilege, and the reason actually why I thought of this is because I was on a podcast interview recently and someone asked me, you know, what's a bit of advice that you would give someone if they find themselves as the one with power in the room? Like, how can I help elevate, you know, the voice of the other in the room? And I thought, well, just don't say anything. Like, you don't have to ask a question. You don't have to do anything. You can just sit there and be quiet. You know what I mean? Like, that is an option, right? And so I just thought of that. And it made me think of, you know, the parenting advice that I don't have to assume that I'm the only one with knowledge. I don't have to assume that I'm the wisest, or, you know, I can trust that my child has their own wisdom, right? I can trust, you know, we don't have to interfere. And so anyways, that reminded me of what you said, that yeah, we don't have to assume. And because, you know, as evangelicals, I wasn't raised evangelical, but I spent time in the evangelical church. And yes, I was taught that we have the knowledge, we have the salvation story, we have the right way of thinking and being, and therefore we must interrupt and interfere with everyone else's life in order to, you know, deliver this. So anyways, I love that. Just non-interference, right? Like just leave people alone. I mean, you know,
just leave them alone. And, you know, and it goes like for proselytizing too. I don't think there's anybody on this planet who has not heard about Jesus.
I say that all the time.
Don't need to tell them. They know.
And I say that all the time.
I belong to a women's hand drum group. I'm going to go tonight. And we don't advertise. We don't knock on people's doors and tell them about the good news of drumming. You know, we don't do any of those things. And yet people come to us, you know, Indigenous women, non-Indigenous women, non-binary people, they come to us and they drum with us and we have a great time. And we're not out there proselytizing, and yet people are coming. Yet people come to us. You know, for a while before COVID happened, I was going to a monthly moon ceremony up in Hagersville on a nearby reserve. And again, wasn't advertised. Nobody's, hey, have you heard the good news of moon ceremony? But people came anyway. And so what if churches took kind of the same approach? Let's just be good people in our community, working together towards the common good. And if people want to show up, they show up. If they like us and they want to hang out with us, then that's what they'll do. But it's scary when you've been taught, like I said, I grew up during the, you know, Satanic Panic and, you know, and all those Rapture movies. And when that's what's hammered into you, you know, right down to being told, well, if your friend was standing in front of an oncoming freight train, wouldn't you do anything to save them? And that's what they're told. That they have to do this, that they're saving people from eternal damnation. And I mean, how do you not act that way when that's what you're told and you believe that what you're doing is good? And yet look where that attitude has gotten us politically. Right. It has not gotten us anywhere good. This world is not a nice place when Christians are in charge of it.
Okay. I have a couple more questions for you. So I love this quote again. I'm just quoting you and asking you to elaborate, but you talk about living in wine country and you talk about how the soil is variable with red clay and black earth, and there are dense rocky places and non-rocky places. And then you talk about how wines from the same variety of grape will taste different depending on what the roots sink into and what they wrap around and bring to the surface. Now, what I love is how you connect this to humans. And so you're like, humans are like this too, knowing what our roots sink into, what they wrap around and bring to the surface helps us understand the taste and sensations of our present. And I absolutely love this analogy. So can you just kind of elaborate on that a little bit more?
That part comes a little bit after I have talked about my own family and kind of my own ancestry. And you talked about it a little bit too, is the body memory, the things that our bodies carry with us, because the, you know, DNA, we don't even know all of the things the DNA encodes, right? I mean, there's just, there's just so much complexity there. And so, like, so within me, you know, when I think backwards of, you know, the ancestors who had to exist and live and die in order for me, you know, in order for me to be here, all of their lives and the things that they did, you know, on my, you know, my German grandmother, whose ancestors were brought by Catherine the Great into the Ukraine to displace, you know, the Ukrainians who had been there, you know, because they were good farmers and the Ukrainians were lazy or something. I don't know. They all, Imperials, all people always think about that. Always think that way about the locals. Maybe because the locals have good reason to not want to work for the Imperials. You know, and then I've got the Ukrainians and I've got a grandpa whose name I didn't even know until a year before he died, because he lived under the name of my grandmother's first husband. On my dad's side, I've got, you know, I've got the Hudson's Bay Company man who married into the family. You know, I've got the woman who saved his life. I've got, you know, I've got Ojibwe people. My dad says we were descended from Noah and Moses, because Noah Wesley and Moses Wesley, so I've got all of these vast histories and these lives, and they converge in me. And so what are these relationships then that I have inherited? Because that gives me a set of relationships in this world. It gives me a set of connections to diasporic people, to migrants who are, whether, you know, fleeing climate change or fleeing violence or fleeing any of those things. I am connected to them through my grandparents. I'm connected to their stories. You know, through my mom, I'm connected to people who taught in, who taught Native kids, because she wasn't at a residential school, but she was a white teacher who went north to teach, you know, to teach Native kids. You know, through my dad, I'm tied to residential schools and all. So all of these things, I'm connected to these things. And then what is my responsibility in these relationships? Am I going to just acknowledge the relationships of the ancestry of oppression, as, you know, Aurora Levins Morales talks about that, and just, you know, kind of be the eternal victim and, oh, Canada did me wrong? Or am I going to acknowledge the history of displacement, where my grandparents found safety in a place that made my paternal family unsafe? You know, my mom, in rescuing me from, you know, she was able to protect me from some things. So how do all of those relationships and responsibilities come forward in me? These are the things that I'm pulling to the surface and unforgetting and thinking about relationally. And how do I use these things to build the world that must be, you know, to build the world where we can live together, where migrants can find safety in this place? Because we talk about land back, but we're not talking about evicting people, except for maybe people who have cottages and high-rise condos and like that kind of stuff. Like, if everybody gets one home, nobody gets seconds until everybody's had first. So we may evict those people, but, nobody's being kicked off back to Europe or back to anywhere. There's a way that we can all live here together. And so how do all of these things that I have inherited come to the surface in me and get analyzed and put out into the world? I mean, I look at my boys and all the different ways that they are organizing and living in their communities and, you know, building things. And the kids are all right. The kids are all right. They're bringing good things forward. And I'm really happy with this generation.
That makes me so happy. I love that so much. Okay, I have one last question for you. And I think we've already talked about this, but I just loved this little line that you wrote, and I would love for you to just reflect on it a little bit more. So you wrote, "For hundreds of years, the church had given little care or thought to the small magics of life." And I just love that. The small magics of life. Can you just talk to us about that and just how the church has failed in that way, and how maybe we can do better in paying attention to the small magics of life?
My son recommended the book Caliban and the Witch to me, Sylvia Federici, and she's writing about the witch trials. And so that's the context, you know, for that quote, because we often think of the witch trials as being the result of ignorance and, you know, religious ignorance. And it really wasn't. The church didn't care. It was capitalism needing to get women out of the way, needing to create, you know, the nuclear family and all of that stuff. So the small magics of daily life are that relationship, the capacity to live in relationship and listen to what the land is saying, because that's those small magics, right? Mm-hmm. Reaching out for the medicine and working with them and acknowledging relationship. Like when I think of the small magics, when I think of the women, you know, and the men and the children and the way that they would have lived then, the way that my, you know, my son lives, you know, my oldest, you know, the way that he lives, you know, and I think of the small magics, to me, that's just relationship, going outside and understanding that the world around you is alive in ways that we don't even really understand. And so those small magics are just relationship with those things, understanding the medicines that show up for you and using them in good ways, and then allowing yourself to be, to try to get away from that kind of abusive way of thinking about using, but allow in that kind of reciprocal way where I take what I need and then I give back what they need, as opposed to just this disconnected take, take, take. So that's what I was thinking about when I talked about the small magics. And the church really didn't care. The church really didn't care about that stuff, because that was good for communities. That was good for relationships. That's good for, it's good for an interconnected community, because when you're living in community, in an interconnected community, you're living also connected with the land around you. And capitalism hates that. Capitalism needs us to be mobile.
Right.
It needs us to be able to pack up and move to wherever the jobs are. And that means creating small family units that are dependent on the state instead of each other. Yeah. That means causing us to mistrust our neighbors and the people around us, you know, and mistrust the land itself, pave over it.
Yeah, see it as move resource.
Land from, I thought about that at one point. I talk about how, you know, I can't move the land, but we do that all the time. We do. We dig dirt out of one place and move it to another. We dig gravel out of one place and move it to another. You know, and you know, we're constantly doing that. And it's like, why? Because that's what capitalism needs. That's what capitalism needs. And look what we do. We're living with the consequences of that, of not listening, of not being in a relationship, not paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the first thing that came to mind as you were talking and what you said earlier, like, you know, that the stereotype, you know, we're not mystical, or I'm not mystical, I'm just paying attention, you know, it's that idea of just paying attention, you know, what if the small magics are paying attention? I think that's wonderful. I think that's beautiful. And yeah, you know, what you were talking about the land and capitalism, you know, that was one of the first things that, you know, when world capitalism was sort of like invented, I mean, that was one of the first things it did was create private property, right? And turn the land into resource. I mean, that was one of the first signs of capitalism, was literally making, you know, the land as a resource for what, you know? I think that's so good. Just the notion of paying attention and that reciprocal relationship that we have, with each other, with the land, with, you know, with everything, every created thing. And so thank you so much, Patty. This was such a fun conversation. Your book was
thank
just
you
so-
for having me.
Yeah, your book was so beautiful and so necessary. And so I'm so excited for folks to read it. Do you want to share a little bit about maybe where folks can find you if they want to read more, where they can find the book? Or I know that you have a podcast. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I do. So the easiest place to find everything I'm doing is my website, so daanish.ca, which is daanish.ca. So it's pretty easy. I take two books and it's like, okay, so what do these two books have to say to each other? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just reading one book after another. And what thoughts happen when I put these two, books together? So that's my Patty Crowick at .substack.com. I do have a podcast, which, like you said with yours, you've taken a bit of a break. We're hoping to start recording again in January. So Carrie is Afro-Caribbean, living in Canada, and I'm Indigenous. And so we're talking about basically everything as Black and Indigenous women. Because all issues are Black and Indigenous issues, right?
Yeah.
We talk to a lot of authors and academics, because I find smart people so fascinating. So, you know, we talk to a lot of them. And so, like, the benefit of having a podcast is you get to talk to interesting people. Yep. So that's medicine for the resistance. Both of our traditions have the idea of medicine. And so what we wanted to do was provide people who are pushing back against this colonial system, we wanted to provide them with medicine, provide them with language, provide them with ideas, let them know that they're not the only ones who are thinking or organizing or, you know, producing in this way. So that podcast has been a real ride. The book is basically available for pre-order anywhere that you want to pre-order books in Canada and the United States. Independent bookstores, bookshop.org, I think is the one that in the US that connects independent bookstores. And so they've got it. But yeah, you can pre-order it anywhere, Canada or the US. The book was supposed to be half history, half future. And it wound up being 2/3 history and 1/3 future. And then because there's just so much history to unforget, I'm just really excited about the book being out there and having these conversations.
Well, thank you. I mean, you are doing the work of helping us imagine a new future by unforgetting our past or, you know, unforgetting, our stories. So thank you for this labor of love. Because yes, it is birthing a baby. I actually gave birth to my first book and my baby, like at the same time, within the wow. 6 weeks apart. So it was, it was a very intense time. So I totally understand. But thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it. And, you know, I'm so excited for it to get into more and more hands. And so, So for those of you listening, make sure to check out Patty's book and her podcast and all of her articles and angry tweets and happy tweets and all the things. Thank you so much, Patty. It was so fun.
Thank you so much for listening to The Protagonistas. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review.